Hello, welcome everyone. My name is Arzuma Seni, and it's a great pleasure welcoming to the New York Public Library tonight's influential guests. Seated to my right are author and designer Christopher Salyers, author Buzz Poole, photographer Michelle Bates, author Christopher Bonanis, author and photographer Paul Kwiatkowski, designer and photographer Christian Polt, and photographer J.K. Putnam. Before we start the discussion, huge congratulations go to Christopher Salyers and Buzz Poole for bringing into fruition the whimsical book, Camera Crazy, showcasing the most unusual and unique examples of functioning toy cameras. This new book is more than a collection of plastic cameras. It covers the history and full range of this incredibly popular photography niche. We are here tonight to explore the role of toy and novelty cameras in contemporary photography as an entry point into a broader discussion of analog photography as it exists in the current digital arena. We're happy to see you all in the audience. We have announced for those of you who have brought your cameras, you will have 1 minute per person to tell your stories, so we will keep the discussion on track. Also, you all have a raffle ticket for a chance to win a toy camera from the author's collection. There are 4 cameras to be given away tonight, and we will draw the winning tickets at the end of the program. Also, copies of the featured books are given away as part of the raffle drawing. We have copies of Christopher Salyers and Buzz Poole's Camera Crazy, published by Bristol Publishing. Paul Kwiatkowski's Every Day Was Overcast, published by Black Balloon Publishing. Christopher Bonanis's Instant, The History of Polaroid, published by Princeton Architectural Press. And Michelle Bates' Plastic Cameras, Toying with Creativity, published by Focal Press, available for purchase and signing at the end of the program. I'd like to invite all of you to visit the art collection at Mid-Manhattan Library, located at 455 Fifth Avenue, where you can freely and openly browse one of the largest and most comprehensive circulating collections of books and videos covering every aspect of photography. Thank you all for your attendance, and now it's time to roll into the discussion. It's great to have you all here. So, what is a toy camera, and how is it different than a novelty camera, Christopher?
Well, a toy camera, for the most part, is a simple plastic box camera with a fixed focus, limited aperture settings, and they usually have unique features like light leaks, vignetting, soft focus. Many have been used by artists, photographers to, you know, create new and interesting images that are sort of, you know, outside the traditional realm of photography. And, you know, different than that are novelty cameras, which are really, you know, marketed towards children and usually involving branding or something like, you know, a Fred Flintstone's camera or something like that.
Buzz, did you want to add in?
No, I think that's a pretty good answer.
Yeah, I thought that was a really good description. So why is there such a large audience for toy cameras?
Well, you know, I think it's the twofold reasoning. It's the kind of the advent of cameras like the Diana and Holga and Lomography, which was based on kind of the authenticity of the unexpected, which was really attractive to users, not knowing exactly what they get when they would develop the film. And then, of course, there's the novelty aspect. It's the fact that there are, you know, a kid or a fan of the Flintstones or Hello Kitty or Bugs Bunny or Budweiser just want the object because they think it's cool and it's something that they really are attracted to. And, you know, something we get into in the book is this really started, I think, with the Kodak Brownie in 1900, which is not a toy camera per se, but George Eastman knew exactly what he was doing in incorporating the Brownie into trying to sell this $1 box camera. the brownie was the 19th century, mid-19th century, early 20th century equivalent of a Smurf. The brownies were popular cartoon characters. They'd crossed the Brooklyn Bridge. They had been to various world fairs. Everyone knew what a brownie was. And so kids associated the brownie and thought, this is cool, and you know, for a dollar I can get this, take the photographs, mail it in, and get my prints back. And so here you have the advent of using photography and really transitioning it from a scientific, expensive professional's pursuit. You needed to know about chemical processes, you needed to carry on corrosive chemicals, and because the advent of dry plate technology, where the film wasn't so sensitive, you created a more everyman's kind of photography, which was affordable and accessible.
So it could also be almost a corollary, the same as, you know, motion picture, 35 millimeter motion picture as opposed to digital video, really democratizing the whole process and making it so much more accessible. I think Christopher Bonanis wanted to...
No, I just wanted to add that sort of divide between the professional photography world and the... and what became amateur photography carries through to contemporary toy cameras in a big way, because, you know, if you're confronted with an SLR that has a lot of dials and buttons and mechanical and electronic complication to it, if you are a beginning or even a not-so-beginning photographer, you're inclined to be intimidated by it. It's hard to be intimidated by a Holga. I mean, it's plastic. If you drop it, you know, you didn't break anything very expensive. You know, there's a friendliness that takes away any kind of barrier when you're getting started, which is really important.
I think, too, you know, Buzz used the word attraction. I think that's a really important word when it comes to novelty cameras. I mean, I think people are attracted to them because of the way they look, because of the design. Sylvie, you see up here on the left-hand side with Mickey Mouse there. I was photographing her and her younger sister, and I had, you know, a bunch of cameras with me, but they were fighting over Mickey Mouse, of course. I'm not sure they even ever heard of Mickey Mouse, but that's the one they wanted to play with because, you know, it's just recognizable as a character, and... you know, the design of it is the most drastic and kind of luring, I think, out of all the other cameras I had. So they went for it.
And I think the sort of playfulness of the novelty cameras, sort of you see that in the designs for a lot of toy cameras, especially the Holga Lomography. You know, choosing bright colors. You know, loud, punchy cameras that just are immediately catch your eye and, you know, basically proclaim your love of analog film.
You know, this almost reminds me of the, you know, the Emax that were in the bright, you know, those really saturated colors, and they almost look like toys, like toy computers, almost the same kind of concept. Michelle?
There are so many ways in which working with the toy cameras and the Holgas is different from using a real camera, and that fun element, it is something that the photographer can enjoy, that it's not so precious, it's light and it's cheap. And also the people who are being photographed, there's a real different experience being approached by one of these, especially a colored one, versus a big SLR, and so they can get you into situations where you wouldn't otherwise be allowed to photograph, and also make your subjects feel more comfortable. So I've found a lot of people, you know, were doing photojournalism and editorial work, real professionals using these cameras, and it lets them get into situations that they wouldn't be able to get into with a more like real fancy, big, intimidating camera.
I never thought of that, but I always thought of it as not intimidating the photographer. But of course, you're right. It doesn't scare the subject either, because it looks like how can you be intimidated by that, or by a Mickey Mouse camera, for heaven's sake? You know, you can get. That's right. People don't tighten up in that same way.
And after all, it's a lot of fun. So photography is a very serious business. So their photographers are shooting all week long with their super heavy SLR cameras or digital SLR cameras. They still want to shoot on the weekend, right? So, of course, they take a toy camera because it's something different, it's lighter, it's more fun, it's more enjoyable at some point.
And Paul, I think you were...
Yeah, I mean, I guess stepping back, it just seems like when you're shooting with your iPhone, you're shooting with digital, you know, it's kind of like a really inverted process. It, you know, it keeps you locked to your computer, onto your iPhone. And I think just being in such a time of pessimism, people are reaching out to objects, toys, and, you know, kind of becoming a bit of fetishists at this point. And I don't know, maybe that's what it takes.
Now, is it fair to categorize the original Polaroid instant camera and other instant cameras as toy cameras? I know Christopher Bonanno is going to respond to that.
The short answer is no, not the originals. The first Polaroid cameras were large and heavy and very fine photographic instruments. They were all metal. They were with a leather covering or a fake leather covering. They weighed almost 5 pounds. They were larger. They were similar to but larger than this. And even more sort of intimidating looking. And they had rather fine lenses. They were pitched at the top of the amateur market, but they had good lenses and could make very high quality photographs. They were also extremely expensive. The first one in 1948 was just under $90. It would be $1,000 now. It was really, you were investing in something like buying a laptop, the way you'd be buying a laptop or an iPad or something now. And it it was not a purchase to be decided upon as a sort of whim. There was a great concern at Polaroid, especially in the early years, but even for 50 years after that, that their idiom not be considered a toy, because that was the easy knock on it from the other side of the from other companies marketing. Kodak suggested, well, this is something for weekend amateurs, but if you want to take real pictures, you shoot them on 35mm film. They pushed back against that very hard. They would get cameras into the hands of people like Ansel Adams in order to prove that a Polaroid picture could be as high quality as a Kodak snapshot, a Kodak picture. And that was something they felt very strongly. That said, in the 1970s, when the one-step, the little plastic box camera that many of us grew up with, came along, it was cheap. It was about $30 then. And it got this rather elite form into the hands of many, many, many millions of people. And that included a lot of kids. And that began its sort of transition to a much more democratized way of taking pictures. And I think that's where the idea that it was a toy camera idiom came along. But there was always sort of a professional-grade Polaroid enthusiast base that fought back very hard against the idea that it was a casual sort of throwaway medium.
Actually, the correspondences between Ansel Adams and Edwin Land are quite fascinating, so some of you might want to look into those. And what you were describing about the original Polaroids that were so heavy and solid reminded me of the Sony Walkman that came out in 1980. Mm-hmm. And those were like 200 and up, and they were so solid and heavy. And then as time went on, those Sony Walkmans became
I don't think they wanted
cheaper.
It to be any... they wanted it to be smaller and lighter, and they couldn't quite get it there in the beginning. But there are striking correspondences between Edwin Land, the founder of Polaroid, and Akio Morita, the founder of Sony. They were both... they were friends, in fact. They knew each other well and would pay calls on each other when they visit, you know, when Morita was in the U.S. or when Land went overseas or at conferences. They'd meet up and sort of renew their friendship. And they compared notes. There's a scene I mentioned in my book when they met in the 1970s. Polaroid was introducing a line of instant movie cameras. It was movie film that developed in 90 seconds. It was a fantastic technological achievement, and they demonstrated it for Morita, and he had just introduced the Betamax. And he sat back and he said, "You're too late." And he was right. Betamax clobbered the Polaroid instant movie system. It was called Polavision.
Actually, that project sort of led to Polaroid's kind of was the beginning of the downfall.
It didn't kill them, but it was the first thing they got wrong in a big way, and it cost them a whole bunch of money at a time when they had it to throw away. They were bringing in billions of dollars, and it cost them maybe, I don't know, $100 million or so. So it wasn't a mortal blow or anything, but it was certainly the beginning of a problem.
Yeah, and going back, you know, that was really a pioneering thing they did by bringing on these famous photographers to really play with the materials. And the result of that was the incredible art collection that they, you know, amassed. And
that's right. They called it the quality campaign in-house. They wanted to prove, as I said, that they were in the same league as the other makers of film and cameras. And so they would send off cameras and film, you know, by the carload to people like Ansel Adams and Walker Evans and Andy Warhol and Paul Caponigro and many, many other prominent photographers or budding photographers, students and people, with the thought that they might turn into something great and be fans for life, you know. And the only stipulation when they gave all this stuff away was that you send us some of the good work. And it did two things. It amassed a huge art collection at Polaroid, more than 20,000 pieces of photography encompassing everything, scientific photography and kids taking pictures and Ansel Adams landscapes, the whole run of it. But it also allowed them in their advertising and marketing and other published material to use these fantastic photos and say, you know, you could be this good. Use our stuff.
Buzz?
And this is probably also a really great distinction on as to why the Polaroid is not a toy camera, whereas with the Diana and the Holga Lomography, you had artists drawn to these cameras just by virtue of the images that they were able to create and those surprises, and people like Warhol shooting them and just being kind of, whoa, this is incredible. As far as I know, Holga and Diana and Loma were not going out and soliciting photographers in the way that Polaroid was, you know, a very sophisticated marketing campaign. And it was kind of the exact opposite, that people were just drawn to the unexpected nature of the image creation.
They actually validated by you know, Andy Warhol and Walker Evans and Liz Krims, you know. They validated the use of instant cameras as fine arts tools.
For sure. I had a question for you, actually. Were I know Holgas were not pitched to professional photographers, but do they use them in situations where they don't want to carry a camera that could get damaged? Is
yeah.
there a sacrificial quality to them?
Sure. You know, they're cheap. the Holga company never made these cameras. They were made for the mainstream Chinese market when 120 film was still used, and then they kind of went out of favor when 35 millimeter got popular. And the Holga company that made them, Universal Electronics, was as surprised as anybody when they started getting these large orders from the United States because they had been discovered by the fine art market. I wrote the first edition of my book pulling together people doing really great work, professionals and fine artists and different genres of photography. And then the company contacted me saying that they were looking for pictures to hang in their headquarters in Hong Kong. And I said, do you know about the book? And they said, no. And I sent it to them and they were just thrilled. And they put together a little thing called Holga Inspire that is just this little version of what Polaroid did, of collecting some of the good photographers and starting to interact with the photographers in the world. And I brought their representative to New York for the trade show and showed them what Polaroid and Nikon and all these companies do and how they interact with their photographers. And so they've created that relationship, which is pretty fun for everybody. Definitely people who bring cameras in those situations, in addition to regular cameras and to the exclusion of more expensive cameras. I have Teru Kuayama's in here, who's a photojournalist and brings them to Afghanistan and Iraq and Pakistan doing war work, and lots of other people doing them in different situations. When you put them in the hands of, even though they weren't ever made to be used as professional tools like the original Polaroids were, in the hands of a professional or somebody who really knows their stuff, they can be used for any kind of photography, professional, fine art, and all of these levels. So it's not about what the tool was made for, it's about how it gets used.
Would anyone else like to talk about their experience with Polaroid?
I I just have one more thing. I think it's come back around. I have an Instax, which is similar to this new Lomography one, these little instant ones. And I feel like when Polaroid still first came around to the spitting out the pictures, people were really amazed by it. And now everybody has digital cameras. And so when you come around with one of these now and it spits out the camera again, people are amazed again. So I feel like it's come around.
It is still magic. I mean, there is a photo that develops in front of your eyes. And you don't, like with the phone or iPhone, you make a photo, you see it right away, but it's still this surprising effect, and it gets made in front of you. I mean,
there is no comparable product. Right, it's an object, and then they all look at it, and they're like, where's the digital copy? But there is none. But Polaroid, I think, now has one that does both, right?
They do, yeah. It doesn't produce a print on film. It does it with another technology, but yes. No, that fact that it's an object, I think, is important to people, because it feels precious in a way that a digital file cannot. There's only one of them. And if you take it in your hand after it's produced and you destroy it, it's gone forever. That moment is gone. The other thing about it that makes it unique is that it was in the room where it was made. If you're in the Oval Office and you take a picture of the president with your cell phone, well, it goes up to the cloud and whatever. It's a file. It's ones and zeros, same as the picture you took 2 days ago of your lunch. If you take a Polaroid picture in that room, it comes out of the camera, and the president looks at it. And it's in his hand for the moment. And if you take it home, it was there. And you know it was there because you can't manipulate it at all with Photoshop. It's an object, and it had to have been there. That makes it unique as a souvenir of the moment. It touched its own subject, or at least came very close to it. Not many other kinds of art are like that anymore.
I think also the whole, also the in terms of analog photography as well, Polaroid, it's a whole different form of memorizing a moment. So if you take an iPhone photo, you make a photo, you like it, you share it, you get some likes, you forget it. But if you take a Polaroid photo or also a film photography photo, you remember the moment when you took the photo. You bring it for development, or it develops right in front of you, and then you get back your photos, and you have it always there, and you remember this moment way better than with an iPhone, or at least I do so.
You take fewer of them, too, because they cost more.
Yeah, it drains your head.
Well, you know, one of the really greatest functions of Polaroid, especially when they started the 665 series, was that, you know, the photographer was able to take the shot and actually share the positive right there with the people that were being photographed. And that really broke the ice and made things a lot easier. Now, what is the attraction for contemporary photographers continuing to work with film, especially when it comes to disposable and toy cameras?
I can do that.
You also want to hear from JK and Paul as well, because
Well, you know, I think a lot of it, of course, has to do with the results that you get from them, which can be surprising, you know, and beautiful and interesting, you know, maybe different, maybe a little raw, but it's certainly the results you get from the camera itself. You know, and with both of these examples up here, you know, of course, the photo was framed through the viewfinder, but, you know, there's a lot of nice little surprises in there, in using the, He-Man Castle Grayskull camera. You know, as it turns out, there's just this really beautiful, sweet spot, right in the middle of the lens, and when taking a portrait like the one next to it, you know, it lands kind of in the perfect spot, and Voltron down there on the bottom, or up here on the table. You know, just, you know, I was surprised it even took the picture, but, you know, it took a nice, clear picture, you know, nothing too surprising there, I guess, but when you take it to, you know, a cosplay event, walking around with that, it's going to get you a lot of attention. So I think in that way, you know, just the attention to draw probably allowed me to get that picture next to Voltron up there.
You know, everybody kind of has had the experience now of Instagram and all these different apps that make pictures that look sort of like this style. And so there is this thing now where people say, well, why would you want to use film when you can get the same sort of results? And there really is a different experience. I think in any kind of art, it's not really, I mean, it's about the results and it's about your experience of creating the art. And going around and dealing and shooting with something like this is just a completely different type of experience than shooting with any kind of a digital camera. For one, in the sense of you take the picture and then there's nothing to look at on the camera, you know, and shooting a lot with digital, I tend to look sometimes even. but then you're in the world and you keep looking around and you keep interacting with who's there with you and you're not looking at the camera and you're not fussing with menus and things like that. So it's a much simpler experience. And it's a very different way of creating. And the creative mind engages very differently depending on what tools you're using. After that, you're dealing with film, and there's a million different ways to continue with that, some of which you might like or not like, and some people still work in the darkroom, or you might scan negatives and go digital with it. So there's like a million different ways to go out from there, but the shooting experience is very, very different and unique, and that's a choice of how you want to like spend your time and create your art.
Go ahead. I think, yeah, Christopher, go ahead, Paul.
I was just going to say, I mean, I think right now there's like a merging of aesthetics too. You know, as you mentioned, like with putting filters over Instagram photos, you're choosing a moment that's in the present and giving it meaning for the future. Whereas in when you're shooting, you know, with film, it is in the present and, you know, you get the results back however they turn out. And I don't know, it's like I said, it's just massaging it all together. And I guess eventually it'll be all one thing.
And I think, like Michelle touched on earlier, it's, if you're a professional, you know how the camera works. You know its quirks. You know its ins and outs. You know the particular corner where the light leaks. You know how to manipulate it. And if you're an amateur, you sort of just have fun with it. And you know, if you're amateur or pro, you know what a particular camera results are going to be like after you've used it for the first time. So, you know, this Holga may shoot, you know, in your eyes with a particular style that may fit an event or something. And, you know, you may go with, you know, five different cameras to five different functions trying to get, you know, particular results. And when they're plastic and toy, there's an intimacy involved in shooting, you know, and it's a bit more of a, like, you have a relationship with your audience, don't you think?
I agree. I always think of something my friend Dave Bias said. Some of you may know him. He's a guy who worked for the Impossible Project for a long time and is now trying to get a company called Film Ferragna back off the ground. He always said, I'm not against digital. I shoot digital all the time. I have a bunch of digital cameras. He uses Instagram. He puts his pictures on Twitter, the whole bit. But that doesn't mean I don't want another tool in the toolbox. Film looks different. Film in toy cameras looks different from film in professional cameras. Each of those looks is distinctive. It might suit a particular mood or a particular subject or a particular day. And more options are better when you're trying to be expressive.
So one can say the design of the camera determines the style of the image.
Well, I think I don't know about the style of the image. Sort of, I think it influences the composition. It influences how your subject might interact with you. You know, if you're holding a camera that looks like a robot, I mean, you're going to get a different reaction than if you're holding a gorgeous looking, you know, 7D or something. This, for instance, is a Webster's Dictionary camera.
An all-time favorite with librarians.
Yeah. And, you know, it's quirky and weird. And John, you shot these.
yeah, I mean, really, just to back up what Christopher was saying, it is, you know, and Michelle, it does kind of get you in like a back door and maybe even closer to your subject, an allowance that you wouldn't be given otherwise. So, I mean, the two examples you see here, one of them is a model, it was scheduled, the location was secure, and the other one is kind of more of a, on the go, just, hey, can I check out this cool camera I have? Can I take your picture with it? This was actually probably my favorite camera to shoot with for Camera Crazy. It very simple to use, but actually had two functions. It would shoot standard photos, but then has this cheap little plastic lens. You can see it by the number 25 there, that slides in front of the standard lens and gives you this close-up effect. And you can get very close to the subject, as you can see on the bottom, and get a nice blur in the background. But certainly, I mean, the design of this camera, does something that no other camera will do, whether that be because of the close-up lens or because of what it looks like.
Buzz and Christopher, how did you come about, sort of employing J.K. Putnam to do all the, photography for the book? Because he is a great photographer.
It's basically, there are over 150 cameras in the book. Even more in my collection that didn't even make the book. So it's sort of an impossible task to shoot with every single one. We tried. A lot of the cameras shoot with film like 126 that they don't make anymore. So we're using lots of expired rolls. Processing.
And were those rolls kept in the refrigerator?
No.
I would say they probably sat in the box that they came with for like 40 years, like in someone's closet.
Yeah, and when you shoot film on so many different cameras, you end up with a lot of just black roll, and it's frustrating,
to say the least.
Buzz?
Well, so John is a old friend of ours, and we've done a lot of work together on other books, so that it was a no-brainer for us to bring in John to do the majority of the photography for the book, with the exception of the certain images that Lomography and Holga and the Impossible Project were kind enough to let us use, and a handful of some of the more obscure Polaroids. All the actual objectified cameras were photographed by John in a studio, and then certainly the majority of the photographs shot with the various cameras were also shot by him, as well as some other folks.
Great job, John. Now, what was the impetus that led you to realize this book?
Well, it really started with my collection that's been growing probably for as long as 10 years. And I'm sort of a weird collector person, pop culture enthusiast, and I've never seen a book quite like it that catalogs, the weird and quirky cameras that are out there. And I personally would have been, head over heels for a book that was nothing but a catalog of cameras like this that I could buy, because I'm one of a handful of people on the planet that is obsessed over weird, cheap plastic cameras that may or may not work. It grew from there, and we were fortunate enough to strike a deal with Prestel and check it out.
But something that I was pretty emphatic about was it not being a catalog, just a catalog, and making sure that we could tell a story using hanging it on the images, but being able to talk to Tien Lee at Holga, who, interviewing him through an interpreter, having the folks at Lomography in Vienna answer a lot of questions and talk about the background, interviewed with the current CEO of the Impossible Project, Sri Nair, who's a professor up at Columbia. And
yeah, those are all really great, great things that you did in the book.
Thank you.
Make it timeless.
So that was our hope, that because a lot of these cameras are timeless. They will never be made again. And then there's a whole future of stuff that Holga and Lomography and Superheads, Power Shovel are continuing to do, but you know there is a story here, and it does start with the Diana, and then with Holga and Lomography coming out of Russia. You know, these guys from Vienna going over to Prague and discovering all these old Russian cameras, and then how it continues with the Impossible Project and some of these Japanese digital digital camera makers who are making novelty digital cameras, and kind of it all comes full circle.
Now, talk a little bit about Ghost and Company.
Ghost and Company is a small book packager that Christopher and I run and started a few years ago out of our collective experience working on other illustrated books. And this is a rare example where we really did everything. We're the authors and the designer and really kind of did the soup to nuts book. But other projects we've done using other folks we know, and we've sold projects to Lawrence King Publishing, to Akashic Books, and it's all illustrated books.
That sounds great. So to spice up the panel, and also as a refresher, here are the 10 golden rules of Lomography. 1, take your camera everywhere you go. 2, use it anytime, day and night. 3, Lomography is not an interference in your life, but a part of it. 4, try the shot from the hip. 5, approach the objects of your lomographic desire as close as possible. 6, don't think. 7, be fast. 8, you don't have to know beforehand what you captured on film. 9, afterwards, either. 10, don't worry about the rules. So how do these rules apply to digital photography, especially now that almost everyone carries in their pockets mobile cameras with high quality still and video cameras?
Well, I think here you need to add that these golden rules were written 20 years ago. And 20 years ago, people used cameras were used by people to document their anniversaries, Christmas, vacations, and maybe some other special events. And then there was Lomography and the first golden rule, take your camera everywhere you go. And so this all was in combination with this little Lomo camera, which was made in the USSR and brought to Vienna. And then people just started to shoot away with this camera. No thinking, just shoot wherever you go, advance it. And so this took off somehow. So more and more cameras were smuggled actually from Eastern Europe to Vienna, and more the cameras were first given away to friends, and then they were sold to friends, and then the first exhibition followed. And suddenly there came a fax from London that someone wanted this camera. And so it developed all over the world. And I think now with the iPhone, and since everybody now has a camera everywhere we go, it's still very powerful, I think. So it's, and also, I mean, if you see it like this, Instagram is basically the 10 golden rules of Lomography on a new level, because also the filters that Instagram offers are taken from film photography. People share their photos, take cameras, document their lives. The total amount of photos that are taken these days is, I don't know how, I don't know. Does someone know a number?
There's a statistic that has been tossed around a lot. You know the one I'm going to repeat probably, that in 2013 there were as many photographs taken as in all of history before 2013. We doubled it in 1 year.
And what do you do with all that stuff?
Well, a lot of it sits on your hard drive. You know that. Although,
well,
frankly,
this is,
I mean,
which you won't be able to access later because everything just
the formats are, that used to be a problem. I think the formats are pretty settled now, and we're probably not going to go through another transitional period as we did in the early digital era where you lose a lot. I think, especially with the cloud, because things are so widely duplicated and reduplicated, it's getting harder to lose things. All I was going to add is the saying that I've heard many professional photographers repeat, which is that the the best camera to have is not the most expensive or the one that's best suited to the situation. It's the one in your hand when the picture happens. If you have it with you, that's the most important thing, whether it is digital or analog or something else.
There was an exhibition at Pier 24 in San Francisco, and there was an entire room filled with little printouts of, like, it was like 24 hours worth of pictures that had been uploaded to Flickr or something like that. And it was just, you know, the room was like half full of these photos. So really, really interesting way to do that. For the Lomographic rules are really, it is the way a lot of people are with photography these days. And I always like to differentiate between the accessibility of the cameras for everybody, which is super great for all of these, and then the people who are who do think, you know, and get to know them and can use them for other things. So I think there's a stratification between those different types of usage of the cameras, and that they're not just for not thinking and not just for fun, but they can be also used for higher levels of art and commercial work as well.
Also, you have to learn along the way. You know, you're not a photographer until you've taken a lot of bad pictures. Mm-hmm. I mean, they used to say, what was the old saying, 2,000 rolls of film before you knew what you were doing?
But now it's like, everyone's a photographer. Yeah, but it's kind of like, you know, everyone's got a pencil and a pen, but mm-hmm. some people are, you know, artists and illustrators and can draw, right? It's a very simple tool. I can't do anything interesting with it, but there are people who can make magic just with a simple tool like that.
Sure.
But
this everyone's is where a writer, too.
I think this is where toy cameras actually come back to this time of our century. So I think now people make photos with their iPhone, and yes, they're not artists, they are just photographers with their iPhones or people with iPhones, but especially the Diana camera and the Holga camera, it's so great to explore photography again. So you learn exactly how the light goes on the film, what is shutter, what's aperture, what is exposure time. So I think if people start taking photos with their iPhone anywhere they go, and then they see these filters on Instagram, and then they wonder where is this filter coming from, and then they explore toy cameras.
Well, you know, one of the major drawbacks with film was people were always very concerned about the actual cost. So that sort of, you know, limited the number of shots they would take. Whereas with digital, there is no fear. I mean, it's endless in terms of the shots you can take.
Well, people think that, but then you keep having to get a new camera every 2 years, and you keep having to get a new computer, and then you have to buy new software, and then you have to buy more hard drives, and then you have to buy backup hard drives. And it really is like that. Whereas you can use the same Leica or Hasselblad or 35mm camera for your entire career. Like, really, there are people who use the same camera for 40 years and never upgraded. And so there's a real difference there. And film definitely, while it's getting fewer options, it is getting more expensive to use now. And there are ways to minimize that if you do your own processing and things like that. But it's like any art. You know, it's become more of a specialty. You know, oil paints are expensive, all of these things. Just depends how you want to do it.
Oil paint has always been expensive, and film has always been expensive, which, you know, leads to the next question is, can you make a lifetime commitment to shooting film or digital, and bearing in mind how that would really affect the environment? And also, if you had to work only with one camera, what would you select?
I mean,
right, Paul's going for it.
I would say the digital photography and analog photography are just, they can't be kind of lumped into the same thing, because, you know, digital photography is part of our lexicon, is part of our dialogue, is part of our language, and I think it'll continue to be that way, while photography will be something more specialized, and, you know, it'll depend on its context.
Anyone else? I think...
You know, I guess to make a choice, I would probably go with digital. I think this day and age, it's become much more, important to our world and the way that we communicate and share and inform and that sort of thing. I think the ideal example, go back to 1989, CBS News, you know, using digital imaging to broadcast, you know, pictures from Tiananmen Square, kind of the first time that had ever been done. You know, these kind of classic important shots that the world otherwise never would have seen. And then, you know, in years later, Time Magazine covering Hurricane Sandy through Instagram. You know, like things like that I think are really amazing. And that's what kind of sets digital apart. And
absolutely. The immediacy of it and accessibility of it, it's been the best thing that could have happened to photojournalism. And also to, you know, really citizen journalism as well. I mean, the Rodney King situation, you know, I mean, it has incredibly democratized the way that we also treat each other, you know, as human beings. Would anyone else want to?
I mean, I think that fortunately for photographers, we've moved well beyond the argument between digital and analog. And, you know, digital can perfectly mimic the look of analog film. And I don't know, like, it'd be hard to really choose. Well, you could argue. Nothing's perfect. But I, you know, I would have to agree with John. And, you know, if I had to choose, it would probably be digital at this point. But it would feel lacking. And to even, you know, choose a favorite camera or a camera that I would use for the rest of my life, I don't know. I mean, like, could you, Michelle?
Yeah, that's hard. It would be like cutting off one of my arms, because I have this world where this is my artistic muse, my Holga, and that's what I shoot a lot of my art with. And then I have a whole world of digital where I shoot theater and performance, photography, and technically those cameras make much more sense for that. And I shoot with my phone, and I shot a picture of the building outside today to show because it's so cool being here and all of these things. So they're just like, they fill completely different niches in my life. And if I was just having digital, I would just, you know, like have lost this artistic part of my life in way of expressing, which is something I've been using for over 20 years. And it's, you know, film is a pain, like it really is to use. I feel that. But there's a way that I can see through that and communicate that I can't with anything else. And so it's really precious to me. But the tools of digital photography are incredibly useful in for a whole number of ways that are totally different.
You know, when I posed the question, I was sort of thinking, you know, with professional musicians, you know, a violinist and his or her Stradivarius, they are absolutely inseparable. And we have photographers on the panel, and I thought somebody may come out and say, you know, the Leica M3 that I've had for the past 30 years is it, or what have you.
There is a key difference, though, which
well
is that
I just
a
also
violinist
wanted to finish saying that. If we sort of apply this kind of a adversarial thing between digital and analog to the music world, you know, musicians never have a problem going from acoustic to electric. You know, Chick Corea is incredibly versatile, whether he does acoustic piano or electric piano. It's, you know, depending on what he really wants to play. So I think photographers don't have to be pinned down to making a single choice either.
All I was going to add to that is that a musician is either reproducing or interpreting someone else's work or improvising on it in the moment, unless he or she is also a composer, and then he's reproducing the composition he or she made. Whereas a photographer is always reaching out to something, trying to capture something that is external to him or herself, even if it's on a set that he or she has just built. It doesn't exactly correspond to music making, because, you know, if you are wedded to your Stradivarius, it's in part because you are playing 18th or 19th century music that was written for entirely analog instruments of this type. So slightly different game in that way.
I think there's a greater connection between the increase in sales of vinyl records mm-hmm. and the increase in sales of toy cameras. And I think that it's a direct response to the digital age and just being bombarded with HD imagery, and people want that tactile thing that they want to just hold it and feel it and know what it is, you know.
Where do we find the inventive spirit of photography nowadays? Inventive spirit of photography, where do we find it nowadays? Is there an Edward Land somewhere that's growing up and will absolutely change the world?
It's us, of course, and us Lomography. No, actually, I wanted to say it's on Kickstarter, I think. On Kickstarter.com, there are like tons of camera projects and people with great ideas for the photography market, and also a good crowd that is very interested in photography actually and loves to back Kickstarter projects.
And Camera Crazy, as I mentioned, we interview Sri Nair, the creator of The Big Shot, which we will be giving one away this evening. And he grew up in India shooting on old Dianas, and you know, now works in, you know, the most advanced kind of digital imaging you can imagine, and came up with the idea for The Big Shot based on the film Born into Brothels, where the filmmaker gave these children who were born into brothels cameras that they shot, and really he found it very inspiring. But what he went one step further with The Big Shot, it's a kit camera. It's a build-it-yourself DIY digital camera. And he was kind of going on this riff of being concerned that we're, especially children, it will become generations of nothing but users and not builders. And so, you know, I think that's an innovation and getting people, it's not about judging whether or not you're using digital to shoot photography, but it's about actually understanding, as Christian was saying earlier, you know, what aperture is. How is an image made, whether it's, you know, through a lens and onto film or onto a memory card. So I think that is a very innovative idea. And as he says in the interview, he is not, the Big Shot is not in his mind to be thought of as a toy camera, but it's certainly meant to be a playful object. People should have fun with it in the same way that they should have fun with any of these cameras.
So do you think it's a good time now that we open up to the audience and see who's brought a camera that wants to share with everyone else? We've got a actual microphone set up right here at the podium, so just step up and share. Who wants to be the first? I know there are people in the audience that really want to come up and tell a story.
Why don't these folks talk about the cameras they have
up
here?
Exactly. So here's Michelle.
This is a Holga 120N. It's a real basic Holga model, but happens to be gold, because you can see it better from the stage. and, you know, one of the interesting things, too, I really like to show people, not film in this, but the inside of the camera, and there's a real different experience of seeing the inside, which is a little plastic lens and a spring for a shutter, and it's like you can understand how it works, which is completely not the case with any digital camera, and that's really exciting. On the other hand, this is called a Rolly Mini Digi, and it's a miniature model of a Rolleiflex camera, which is a 2 1/4 camera that's usually like this big. They're very old classics, but this is a digital camera. And it's hard for me to say whether it's really like a toy, but it is just so cute and fun, and like it's interactive, and people always ask me about it. And that has a toy element to it that I just really love. And it's light, and I wear it as a necklace, and I like the quality of the kind of crappy digital pictures that it makes. But that's an element of toy camera to me, too, is that kind of interaction, even though this is meant to look like a fancy camera and is reasonably well built. So, and I have an entire room full of toy cameras, too, but these are the ones I brought.
You know, if you put that on a tabletop tripod, it would almost look like an RTD2.
Right. I know. It's so cute, isn't it? What are the size of the images that it takes? Yeah, it's like 3 megapixels. I forget exactly what it was. I was like 1526 pixels square or something like that, and it has a higher setting, but it actually interpolates. Oh, is there like 3 inches? Maybe 5 inches at 300 DPI. Yeah, but they have a certain quality to them. They're not really like perfectly clear. But I really like the way that they. I don't think they make these anymore. Yeah, there are other miniature cameras. There's little Leicas and stuff like that too.
When it comes to the digital toys that a lot are coming out in Japan, and they all hang around like 3 megapixels, and I think they're all just they're keeping the technology at a minimum to sort of like mimic, you know, the look of, you know, a Holga or something.
Oddly, the Rolleiflex that this is in tribute to is actually a very, very high quality camera with 2.25-inch square negatives, which is huge and makes really great photos. So it's kind of funny that way.
I brought two. Both made in the same year, I believe. This was Polaroid's highest-end camera in 1965. This is called a Model 180. And this was similar to their mainline cameras, but this was the fancy one aimed at the professional market. And it was very expensive at the time. I think it was about $180, something like that, $190. And it is an imposing photographic instrument. I can't do the microphone and the camera at the same time. And it's heavy, and it's substantial, and it has a very good quality lens, manual controls, and right now I have on it a portrait kit so you can go in close. But it is intimidating to people, as I was mentioning earlier. I mean, it's a big thing. When you hold that up to your eye and close in on someone, they react. Polaroid at that time had just introduced color film, and it was extremely successful. People were buying it in great quantity, as fast as they could make it. So much so that the black and white production line at Polaroid had gone idle, and they wanted to get it going again. The color had cannibalized it. So the solution was to come up with a cheap camera that would shoot only black and white film and to pitch it very low to go for teenagers. And the result was this, which was called the Swinger. And it looks, you know, it's sort of the same form. The film pack was slightly different, but it hits some of the same design notes. It's adorable in its way, and it relates to some of the toy cameras we've been talking about and seeing here. And it was $19.95, $20. And it was, if you were a teenager in 1965, this is what you wanted for Christmas. And see? Did I say? Yeah. 1965, sorry. It was a smash. They sold, I think, 7 million of them. Someone's here saying you had it in Puerto Rico, and that's how popular it was. It was popular worldwide. I've seen them with the instructions on the back in German and Spanish, and you know they made them all. They sold them rather all over the world. It was also a craze that burned itself out pretty fast. It only took off for a few years and then faded away. They once did a study that the average teenager ran about 2 rolls of film through it and then got tired and put it in the closet, which is a problem. And in fact, that confirmed some of Polaroid's worst fears about being perceived as a toy, and they backed away from that for years afterward. Nonetheless, they made a lot of money on these. And I don't know, a Polaroid executive once said he thought this was the ugliest thing they'd ever sold. I think it's adorable myself.
Well, Christopher, the one from 1965 is structurally is very similar to the, you know, the Graflex cameras.
Yeah,
for example, VG's, you know, camera that you see.
That's how they were made.
Yeah,
was somewhat old-fashioned technology even when it was new.
Right, and they continue to sort of make a version of that. I actually have the ProPak 100 with the bellows, mm-hmm. and the flash comes up on the side, and it's such a great camera because I can use the 6600
sure.
films with that. And
A version of this camera was manufactured, yes, well into the 1990s until about 2000, I think. There was a professional market, a small niche professional market that continued to use them and still does continue to use them in very small numbers, mostly for proofing. That is, when you set up in a studio before you shoot film that's going to be sent off to be processed, you take a test shot with a Polaroid to make sure your lighting is the way you want it. And that market lingered. And there were other special niches, too, scientific cameras and things like that, that they kept making them for.
JK, I think you brought a couple of cameras, too.
I did. I grabbed a handful from Christopher Salyer's collection and a couple of my own. kind of based off design. I guess a couple of them we talked about already. Everybody always likes this one. This is the chocolate donut camera. And it is digital. You don't have to squeeze film in there somewhere. I mean, it really, kind of tells of its age. It shoots in a square format and has five different color filters, shoots video as well. It's ready for Instagram. But I think kind of the coolest, funnest thing about this, besides the fact that it's squishy and soft, is that the donut hole itself, that's your viewfinder. That's all you get. So
that really caught Michelle Bates' attention. She didn't like that one.
I brought a Budweiser camera. Now it's a camera. But this is just interesting because going back to the idea of novelty cameras, I mean, it's based on design first. Its intent is to deceive you and fool you and look like something else besides a camera. So it's a camera second and a can of beer first. Voltron, actually, one thing I like pointing out about it, this big lens sticking out of his belly is a false lens. It does nothing. The lens is actually up here above that. The viewfinder's on his right shoulder there. It shoots 110 cartridge film, so they easily could have made, a Voltron character that looked just like Voltron, and it would have been really cool and still shot pictures, but they wanted it to look like a camera, not necessarily Voltron himself. So I thought that was interesting.
And you brought the dictionary camera, so you're going to demonstrate it.
Yeah, the dictionary camera. It's actually another real, real wacky design. I mean, for one, the cover of the dictionary camera is on the wrong side. That would be the front cover of a real book. Oh, good point. But then, yeah, to access the camera and having to unfold it like this, and the words are upside down now, and really, really kind of funky, but really fun camera to shoot with. And there's that lens I was talking about.
It's also just worth mentioning, because of the book, there is also this 19th century kind of tradition of what known as disguised cameras. Cameras that are made to look like pistols, like books. And so you have this kind of these worlds colliding, and these were very much not toys in any way, but they were based on the popularity of Sherlock Holmes and the Wild West and detectives and gumshoes and all this, these people.
And that's sort of around 1852, right? Could you talk about that in the introduction?
Yes, and so in the book was a very popular format for these disguised cameras, so you could go and spy on people. I think Christian has some cool things to show.
Well, I brought my Lomo LCA, a camera that I shoot for 7 years. And for one, it still works, 7 years. I take it everywhere I go. And what me fascinate a lot is that it never got boring shooting it. So in all these years, I'm always surprised about the photos that are coming out. Of course, I'm using different films and different development methods of the film, but still, out of the 36 photos, I don't know, 5 or 10 are always very surprising, and it's just wonderful to flick through photo prints and be remembered of when you took the photos, actually. And they're all over my apartment, are photos somewhere. And so I never forget this. And the second one is the Lomo Instant camera, which was launched by Lomography earlier this year on Kickstarter. And it was a huge success. And it's a very easy to use instant camera that uses this Fuji Instax mini film, which is kind of the new Polaroid. So it's a very widely available film. The camera is easy to shoot, easy to learn, but if you get into it and you want to try it and you start to experiment, You can add lenses. You can have a close-up lens and a fisheye lens. You can play with the white. You can play with long-time exposure, double exposure. So you can get really experimental. It's really good fun. The Lomo LCA. It's a film camera, so it's really fun.
Okay, if you have a question, just come up to the podium because we want to make sure. Yeah. Yeah. Okay, good. So just.
Use that one right there. My question is I read in the book Polaroid, this history of Polaroid. Something that intrigued me is the people who bought the old factory in Enschede, Netherlands. That's where it was, no? Are they the same people? They know each other from Lomography, the people who bought Lomography? Are they connected somehow when they were doing this venture in the beginning?
It's a little complicated, but and I'm sure you can fill me in on details. Broadly speaking, just to explain, when Polaroid stopped making film in 2008 and 2009, they gradually shut down and demolished all their factories. And the last one to go was in a town in the Netherlands called Enschede. And a couple of days before it was to be shut down, at the closing ceremony, the plant manager, who was not so happy that it was going, met up with a Lomography executive named Florian Kaps. I think he was the founder of Lomo, or co-founder. Do I have that wrong?
He was one of the early employees.
All right. And the two of them hatched a plan that afternoon to buy the factory and try to start it up again. And it was a ridiculous quest. The factory was not an all-in-one. You don't just turn the machines on and they start spitting out film again. They had to all the supply lines for the weird chemistry that goes into an instant picture had dried up. All the people Polaroid had bought their chemicals from had stopped making them. Some of them had gone out of business. One of them, their plant had been demolished by Hurricane Katrina. There were many, many obstacles to starting this up again. And they spent about a year getting a test product onto the market, and the first generation film was pretty awful. It took several cycles before it got sort of usable and manageable. But they have done it. They now have a working company that produces pretty okay film, and it gets better and better with each batch. It's called the Impossible Project because they had such a hard time getting it going. And they are not formally connected to Lomography, but their products, I think you sell them in the stores, right? And or did at one point in any case.
We don't sell it in our store, but I don't know. We are...
My mistake.
At least here in New York, we're good friends with the Impossible Project, yes.
I see. As I said, it's a little complicated. I think it's fair to say that the two enthusiast bases have a great deal of overlap.
No, definitely. So, I mean, I know Florian Kaps as well as I know the founders of Lomography, and both are very, I don't know, maybe the new Edwin Lanz of analog photography.
Maybe.
On that note, I'd like the Impossible Project ending this exciting discussion. We are here to do the impossible, and we still have a lot to do. We have to draw the winning tickets, and we also have the books to give away. So thank you so much for participating in Design and Style series. And now we move on to the rest of the evening. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you.
So does everyone has their raffle ticket?
So here comes Anne. So we're going to, with the tickets.
Thanks to the generous, to Prestel and to Princeton Architectural Press and Black Moon Publishing and Lomography and Christopher, we're going to give away Michelle and Focal Press. We're going to give away four little gift bags here. So get out your raffle ticket. And what's the first bag of goodies?
Sorry. This is a couple cameras from Lomography. This is the Action Sampler Flash. It's kind of cool. And also another action sampler. What's the difference?
One has a flash, the other doesn't.
There you go. One has a flash, the other doesn't. Both action cam, and there's film included as well. So you can...
Oh, that's very generous. That's
oh. Yes.
And Michelle's book, Plastic Cameras. And all these books are for sale as well. All right, so... Hey,
so here comes the first winning ticket. And the number is?
201-2115.
All right. Come on up. Come on up. That's great.
Can't say that anymore.
So here comes Christopher back on to the next bag of goodies. What do we have now, Christopher?
Some more Lomography. This is the Super Sampler, which is in-camera crazy. It's pretty cool. It takes 4 shots per frame, and you sort of pull the ripcord, and it just click, 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 click. And also the Pop 9. I believe it takes 9 pictures per frame.
Wow.
And film included as well.
That's a fun book to read. Yeah, recommend it, definitely. And here comes the next winning ticket, number...
201-2101.
Who got that one? Woohoo! All right. And here comes the third prize.
Up next is...
Ooh.
This is the La Sardina DIY kit. It's sort of made for you to alter and sort of style it up how you want. And included with this is a 3-pack of Lomography film.
How wonderful.
And every day is overcast.
Yes.
All right. Yeah, that's why you have a flash with that one. That's perfect for overcast days. And the winning ticket is?
201-2095.
All right. Here we go. And did you come all the way from Buffalo to attend this event? All right, and here comes the last one.
Last but not least is the, as Buzz mentioned earlier, the Big Shot digital camera and a copy of Camera Crazy.
Woohoo! And Christian is drawing that winning number.
201-2093.
And who won that ticket?
No.
Come on, somebody in the audience has that ticket, unless they left.
Okay, let's try it again.
All right, so let's... Are you sure? Check. More. Everyone, check your tickets. Make sure...
Okay, one more time. Attention. 201-2093.
It ends with 93. Okay, go for another one.
Did someone leave?
Please, Christian.
Mm-hmm.
201-2106. Who?
Yeah.
All right. Congratulations. That's lovely. Actually, the winner of the last... camera is Diane Radacki, the art historian and author and the authority on Paula Motherson Becker. Thank you so much. This was such a lovely gathering, and it's now time to move on to book signing.